You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host for the most, Nikki Kolula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very special guest, a very talented songwriter, very exceptionally talented guitarist, Mr. Matt Heineke. How are you, Matt?
I'm well, Nikki. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And you know what? A fun fact, I want to make it clear, you and I were in the same songwriting class back at USC. We go way back, and I will tell you, Matt, you were an inspiring songwriter in that room, always bringing in great songs, always having the chops. It was awesome. And you don't know this. I was going to start the show with this, but I've got a song called If I Could. And I brought it in, and it was originally called The Key. And Pat Caddick, our teacher, was like, any comments? And you were like, I think it should be called If I Could. And I was like... It should be called If I Could. That is a great suggestion. So
the heck of a memory there. That's awesome.
Song is named If I Could because of your comment. Because I was like, If I Could is a much better title than The Key, because the song poetically is all about If I Could, like the whole thing. So I owe that to you. And I want to say another thing. You told me about a Lyle Lovett live record.
Ah, now we're talking.
That was life-changing for me because I went out and bought it. Anytime you'd make a suggestion in class, I would go out and buy that record that day. Or I don't know if you remember, like, you could buy CDs on your discretionary card. So I'd go look for it there first. If I couldn't find it, I would go to the warehouse or the, you know, whatever, the Virgin Megastore and find it.
Those were the days, man.
And those records, I'll tell you, it was Peter Gabriel, The Secret World. That was one of your suggestions.
Still
one of my top five. And the Lyle Lovett Country Record Live.
Is that the Live in Texas with his large band?
Yes. Like those are two records. I mean, part of me thinks like you need to just be posting records every week. I'd still go buy them. I'd still go listen to them because you hit it out of the park. And I would listen to other people's suggestions, and I would go listen, and I'd be like, they weren't as good as Matt's. Matt's always out of the park, man. It was like every time. So I want to thank you for that because you gave me a lot of
No idea. I had no idea I meant this much to you. Thank you for sharing that.
And you are such a talented cat. I mean, you know, I have so many questions. First of all,
yeah,
I know you started playing guitar pretty young. You were like 11 or 12. Is that right?
I was like 8.
Wow.
Yeah, but I had a couple of false starts where it didn't quite work out. I was a Navy kid. We were living in San Pedro, believe it or not, LA. Wow. I found this guitar in the closet. My dad was a naval officer, and I was like, what's this? And I at the time didn't know what it was, but still have it. It's a 1956 Martin that my dad got as a high school graduation present.
Wow.
And he was just always cool about it. Like, oh, yeah, that's my guitar. You should, you know, go ahead and mess around with it. He never really learned how to play much. He learned like 4 chords and that was it. And I kept begging my mom, like, can you get me lessons? I want to try this, you know. And she did. And we moved to San Diego and I stopped playing because I didn't have a teacher all of a sudden.
Right.
So that's, you know, so I had a couple false starts, a couple teachers didn't click, but then. Yeah, like middle school. I think that's when I discovered Slash. And then that was like, you know.
Like, this is it. This is it. And you
this
know what?
What I want to do.
There's always somebody. Was it like Appetite for Destruction or was it like November Rain? What was the song that you were like?
Oh, no. I still remember it to this day, man. It was the You Could Be Mine video with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I was like, because awesome. I'd heard about Guns N' Roses, but they were kind of like, they always seemed a little like, it, like on Bad Boy, you know, like I don't know if I'm ready for this kind of thing, you know. And then I saw that video, I was like, dude, this is awesome. Who are these guys? You know, and then my cousin, I remember, gave me Appetite for Destruction on tape after that. I was like, okay, I'm all in. The Use Your Illusion wasn't even out yet. That was like a few months before it got released.
Yeah, I think it was like 89, maybe 88, 89.
No, it's like 91, 90. I think. Or yeah, 91, right. 92, somewhere around there. Yeah.
That makes sense. I have one cool Slash story. He played at the Forum with Dave Grohl for his birthday concert. Yeah. All right. Yeah. And the show just ended, and I booked like early, like right as soon as it ended, I was out the door and crossing the street into the parking lot, and Slash pulls up. He just sat in with Dave Grohl. He pulls up in like a giant SUV. It was, I don't know what it was, but it was, he was in this giant SUV. Everybody's crossing the street, and I make eye contact with him, and I was like, you were awesome. And he was like, thanks, dude. And everybody not knowing that Slash is in the car. They were just like, okay, let's go. Let's get in our cars. And I couldn't believe that everybody was crossing the street and Slash was just sitting at the little cross, the traffic light. That's my only moment I've ever had with him. But he was so iconic for you and myself as a guitarist. Always the Les Paul. No, it's just epic.
I can't imagine my upbringing or just my musical development without that initial influence. Like, it's still there. I still listen to it. I'm like, God damn, you're good.
Yes.
You know, just his phrasing, his tone, everything. It's just there. It's like,
did you listen? Did you like learn his solos? Did you learn the songs?
No, like, you know, I've never been that kind of guitar player. I don't know. Like, I don't know. Cause you and I both always, I remember you were into like jam bands, like me, like Fish and stuff.
Yes.
And I originally wanted to be, when I met you, I was a jazz guitar major at USC, studio guitar. And, you know, I was always much more of like the improv, see where this goes. And that, you know, there's a lot of musicians I know that want everything to sound just like the record and just honor every note for note. And that, there's nothing wrong with that, but I happen to have always wanted to do, like, I feel like it's a canvas for you to do your own interpretations.
That makes sense too, because you had a lot of chops. When I remember, you know, like you were just like young, full of fire, and just like you had learned like so much stuff. You had so much versatility as a guitarist because you were playing jazz solos, you were playing rock solos, you could play funk. You just knew all the bags. But I wanted to ask you, like, when you were in high school, were you just shedding like crazy? Were you just learning the instrument? Because like I didn't have that until I was in college. Like I started so late. I started when I was in college.
Yeah, you know, I was a band geek. I was playing saxophone, believe it or not, because that's all we had. And I was trying to play guitar on the side, but there was no outlet at school for that. And so one day the band teacher pulled me aside. He was like, hey, I want you in the jazz band. I need a guitar player. I looked at him like, what? He said, I'm starting a jazz band. And I said, oh, well, that sounds great. So I show up, I brought a Strat in, you know, like it's all I had. And it was like Mexican made Strat. And I remember he put like a chart in front of me. It had all these like crazy changes that I'd never seen before. E flat, minor 7, flat 5, you know. I'm like, what does any of this mean? And he's like, well, can you just play like E flat minor? I'm like, I think so. I'm like doing like power chords, you know, like, but that was it. Like I knew I was like, okay, this is totally different than anything I've ever seen. And, obviously there's a whole lot to this instrument I know nothing about. And just,
what kind of songs were you playing like with the band?
It was all like big band charts, just big band charts, awesome. You know? We had a good horn section and, you know, occasionally we did something a little more funky, like, you know, like I remember doing some Santana stuff in that band, but it was like traditional big band stuff. And so I was playing a Strat, literally. Like I felt like so out of place and like I need to do this right, you know? And I really wanted to learn the chords up the neck and learn how to improv over these things. So I got with a private teacher that kind of helped me get through it and took off, you know? That was
it. Who were you listening to in high school? Was it Fish. The jam thing? So Fish, yeah,
around the same time, because my best friend at the time, he had an older brother in college, and his older brother came home from from school with like two Phish CDs, I remember. And he's like, you got to check these bands out. This band out. And it was like Picture of Nectar and Riff. Yes,
that's my favorite. So, right.
And I put them on and I was like, I remember listening going, oh, this is totally, I've never heard anything like this in my life.
Yes.
You know that feeling. Like, I remember saying, I'm like, can I take these to my house for a couple days and just kind of marinate, you know, like, it's just like, but yeah, that was where I realized like, okay, there's some really cool stuff out there. That's not whatever's on the radio. This is, you know,
my old teacher, he said, he opened for Phish way before they were Phish that everybody mm-hmm. knows. And I was like, man, do you remember like what they played? Like, do you remember? And he was sitting there and he was like, David Bowie. And I was like, oh my God, yes, David Bowie. Like, it was just, it was so cool. Cause he was like, yeah, they weren't really like the band that they are now. They weren't,
huge. Yeah.
They were just like jamming for fun. And that's what made them cool. And it just started catching on, you know. But those records were major influences on me because it was like bending all the rules of music. It was long solos. It was, you know, like weird lyrics. Like, it was
stream
like
of consciousness. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny though, because I feel like everybody has, every non-Phish head has some sort of thing that they identify with them. And it's always different. Like my wife, she's not someone I would consider into jam bands or that scene. Like we have a lot of shared taste in music. She loves the singer-songwriter stuff. Like, we have that in common. But like, one day I think we had Phish on the background and out of nowhere, like I got no response out of her. I could tell she wasn't really checked into it. I could just tell. I don't know where she's like, are these the guys who sing the tires are the things on the car that make contact with the road? And I was like, of all the songs to know out of nowhere, that's the one, you know, like, there's a story here. It's like, you know,
so. Well, it's infectious music and it is hooky. Like, it is crafted songs that maybe won't be on the radio, but they'll catch your ear. And totally. They're extremely musical. Like, I always love them. I opened up for Paige McConnell on his Vida Blue tour. And man, I gotta tell you, we played. They want us to open as an acoustic duo. They're like, "Hey, man, there's no room on the stage because Paige has his whole setup." And I was like, "No problem." So I was sound checking, and literally the entire stage was all keyboards. It was amazing. And then we go up to our room, and this is still in 20 years. This has not happened. He knocks on our door, and he says, "Hey, you guys, the opening act?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I'm Paige." And I was like, "Hey, man, I'm a huge fan. Like, you are such a big influence." And he's like,
"That's so cool.
House of Blues gave us a bunch of food and we're just having dinner. You guys want to come over and have dinner with us?" We ended up hanging with him the entire night before the show. Afterwards, a friend of mine who's a huge Phish head, I got him free tickets. I got him the meet page. It was like one of the coolest hangs I've ever had with a musician. And I left thinking, those guys are musical geniuses. And they're the coolest. Like, that you don't see. You don't see people that are doing like that level of musicianship, and then they're cool and down to earth. So I was just like so blown away. So it made me love the band even more. But did you ever go on like Phish trips? Like, did you follow the band or see them live or anything like that?
I did some road trips to see them, but I never went like city to city, if you're that's what you're talking about. I drove up to like Shoreline. I saw them in Vegas. Stuff like that, but just like one night only kind of thing.
We were probably at the same shows during college because that was like the band and the thing to do. So were you learning? Were you learning those solos, or just kind of like jamming over those?
And jamming over I remember when I was in the USC guitar program for our jury, we had to transcribe a solo, and I picked. I don't think the professor really dug my choice, but I picked Billy Breeze.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, because I thought it was a really beautiful, I still think it's a very beautiful solo. It's very melodic, and it's, you know, it's not a bunch of noodling. Like, sometimes Trey can go a little far into the noodling thing, but it's just very tasteful. Every note's in its right place, and the tone and just the phrasing and everything is I still love it. I still listen to it. I'm like,
ah, and what, yeah. What did you play it on? Do you remember? Because I'm sure you're
on my Les Paul studio.
Wow.
Which I don't have anymore. I sadly sold that guitar.
Oh, but, no, why?
Yeah. Don't sell it. Well, I upgraded. I got a 58 Les Paul reissue. Wow. So it was just not getting loved, and it put it towards other things that are getting loved. So,
well, I also want to ask you this question, because I was in the classical music program, and I was not that thrilled about like the musical vibes. I wanted to ask you. You went through the program. What were your things that you loved? What were the things you didn't love? Because music school is a test. It is like it pushes and pulls the wrong things, I think, out of students sometimes, and pushes them into environments that aren't really how the music industry works. And I think that's the one thing about music schools that suck, you know?
Well, you know, I didn't stay in that guitar program for a few reasons. One, like you, I met you in the songwriting. No, I think you and I actually met in concert choir. I remember
that's
being
right.
in concert choir.
That's right. That is correct.
With Dr. Wilson, rest in peace.
Yes.
You're the best. I remember doing that songwriting class and going, this is exactly where I want to be. This is exactly what I want to be doing. And I remember sitting down with the department chair of guitar and just saying, I'm just not sure I see myself just dedicating myself only to being a guitarist. Like, so much more I want to do. Like, and he said, well, I think music industry might be a better fit for you. And he was right. So I actually transferred after freshman year to music industry.
I remember you told me that because you were like, because I knew what you were going after too. And it's like, it just is weird that music schools, especially at USC, especially during that time, they were so rigid. It's like, if you're
not anymore though. That's the perfect way to describe it. It was just very closed.
So rigid. And do you remember what you were learning at the time? I'm sure you were learning like Charlie Parker solos and like, some student stuff, like
there were so many different. Okay, so here's the thing: the first thing they did was they put me with two private instructors, which I don't think any vocal people had two private instructors. So I had a classical guitar teacher and an electric jazz teacher, and I was like, why am I having to take classical guitar?
Right,
I couldn't. I go there to my first lesson. It was only 30 minutes a week, which is like, I can do 30 minutes a week, but this kind of sucks. This isn't fair. He ended up becoming my closest mentor. Keep in touch.
Who was
David Oakes.
Okay. Awesome.
And he was a fingerstyle jazz player, but he was originally classically trained. And that was the one thing I couldn't do very well when I got there, was play fingerstyle. And I remember I showed up to my first lesson with him, I'm kidding you not, wearing like metal finger picks. And he was like, what the hell is this? But I could play like, you know, a couple like Paul Simon things on, you know,
right.
I kind of taught myself. Nobody had ever showed me, for as much as I knew going in, nobody had ever showed me how to properly finger pick. And I remember like he just immediately like just get those out. He actually like closed the blinds, got out his nail file and shaped my nails. It's like this, you need to start taking care of your nails, grow them out, and like gave me a full-on manicure on our first lesson. It was like the funniest thing in the world. And I still to this day follow his nail advice. Like we became friends after graduation. We jammed after graduation. He visited Nashville. We jammed in Nashville when I was living there. Like he's just an amazing musician and friend, and you know, I had no idea going into that first lesson that he was going to be the one that like I maintained a lifelong relationship with.
Well, sometimes that's what's cool about it. It's like the people you think that you know are going to be influential sometimes aren't, and the people that you don't expect to be influences become those lifelong friends. So,
that's not to say that the other teachers I had didn't have an impact. They did. There was just something really special there. He tapped into just because my first love is the acoustic guitar, like it always has been. And he understood that. And he really helped me. He introduced me to Chet Atkins and just like I was able to take all the exercises he gave me and just like totally broaden everything. So.
You had such a great vocabulary and feel with fingerstyle, which is so funny for you to say when I'm hearing you say, yeah, I didn't really do that. Because I remember you playing the Paul Simon stuff. I remember you playing all the things that I was like, man, I don't know how to play any of that. This is awesome.
Yeah.
So you like you knew where you wanted to go with it, and
yeah, kind of.
You just kind of practicing, like on your own time, the things that you wanted. Was that kind of like the way you kind of?
Yeah, I just would like listen to Pat Caddick was kind of. I was already doing a lot of this, but like he just gave me permission and just listen to as much possible content as you could. I remember how he used to say that it's like, you know, you are what you eat. If you only listen to death metal, you're only going to play death metal, you know. But I just took that to heart. I've still to this day, like I'll play anything from classical music one part of the day to jazz to I'll listen to modern pop music too. Like I'll listen to anything that I find inspiring and honest. That's to me like
you came through music school and you didn't carry that the burden of the nose in the air music school attitude. Yeah. Like you kind of came back into I love music. I'm just going to learn everything and listen to everything and not judge it and just kind of process and just create. So you leave school, you graduate, and you go to Nashville. How long ago, I mean, how long after you finished school did you move to Nashville?
Well, I first got a job at a record label in LA. I did that for a couple of years.
Which label?
Jive Records. Jive.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. But it was like the lowest entry level job in an office of about 15, 17 people. It was small. Their headquarters were in New York City. So Clive Calder.
Okay.
Different Clive. Okay. Yeah. Clive Davis was J Records and Arista before that. But Clive Calder was out of South Africa. He started Zomba Music in I believe London with Mutt Lange was one of his earliest, you know, songwriters and just built this independent thing out of nowhere. And it blew up in the, it had a huge publishing arm, which was Zomba. And then it had the Jive Records label, which had a lot of 80s hip hop, like some of the early, like I'm blanking on who they were, but like Tribe Called Quest and like some really cool early rap stuff. Houdini, like the crazy stuff like that. And then in the mid 90s out comes like the Backstreet Boys and they had this run of Britney, NSYNC, all of those guys, R. Kelly, can't mention that, but and then they had another little umbrella called Volcano Records, which was like Tool and 311, Bowling for Soup.
Oh, I didn't know they were connected. That's amazing. That's
awesome. And then they had this Christian label, which had all the big Nashville Christian stars. It was a very interesting place. So, but we were like the satellite office in LA, and so I was basically working with some of the biggest names and. You know, the guy I answered phones for ended up becoming the head of the Grammys, Neil Portnow. So,
that's crazy.
What
was it like to work with him? You can be as candid or.
Oh, he was so sweet. He was just like, you just felt like you were around like this guy who was a Hollywood icon and been there for a long time and just seen all sorts of great stuff from the golden era and, you know, a better time. But when I got there, I felt like the party was ending because it was right around the time that Napster was out and everything was like slowing down to a very abrupt halt. And so it was, you know, after a couple of years, I wasn't able to really find another job anywhere else. It was, you know, things were closing and shrinking. So
that was kind of a dark time. That was the beginning of history really crumbling fast.
Like, it was an awful time. Nobody was buying records, you know, and it was having an impact. And on top of that, this label in particular, all their megastars were starting to kind of fade in popularity, you know.
Right.
So like that.
Did you see the writing on the wall and just make a pivot and say, I want to be a songwriter. I want to go to Nashville. This is my place.
I pulled the most gangster move. They were bought out by BMG. and they were, BMG was like laying off people basically, you know, and then they offered to let me keep my job and move to BMG. But then I said, I remember, cause I kind of was hoping for the severance package. Cause it was a really good package. And I was kind of like, well, what if I would want the severance package? And they kind of looked at me like, what, you know? And I said, I'm serious. I'm like, is that an option? And they said, I guess so. You really don't want to work here? I said, I kind of want to go to Nashville. And so they gave me this killer severance package, and I moved to Nashville, and
wow,
it gave me that space to kind of get there and get on my feet and get set up. And, you know, kept all my benefits for like 6 months. It was amazing. Then I, you know, got set up over there, but did not want to work for a label again. I really wanted to play guitar and just perform.
And go after it. Like that had to be, yeah. There. Like, especially like working in a label, you realize this is close to music, but not close enough to music.
It wasn't nearly close enough. I was not meant to sit behind a desk and help other people with their music like that. I really wanted to be with a guitar in my hand, figuring out.
Tell me what Nashville was like, because I've been there a couple of times, but moving there and being a songwriter is a definite different thing. And it's awesome.
I haven't been recently, so I'm overdue to visit. I keep talking about it. It's on my radar, but I think this part hasn't changed. I know a lot has changed, but this part was completely different from LA. It was so much more of a communal environment for creativity. I'd never seen anything like it. I'd never seen, I just remember, because I went there, dude, I seriously didn't know a single person when I moved there.
Wow.
I got connected through the guy we were talking about earlier, my friend Dave Tuff. He was still living in LA, but he had some friends in Nashville, and he introduced me to one who introduced me to a guy who needed a roommate. So that big check box, you know, that was lined up before I drove out.
In LA? Did you meet Dave in LA?
Dave and I met in LA. Yeah. He was working for Warner Chappell. I was working at Jive. It was just crazy. And then, I remember like sitting there once I moved into this house and bought a bed and all that, and like just staring at the wall going, shit, what do I do? I really don't know anybody. Like, so I just like, I'm going to go to an open mic. So I went to the Bluebird Cafe's open mic night.
That's awesome. I still on my list.
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly, it's like a giant cattle call. So back then, I'm sure it's crazy now, but back then you would show up and take a number and they would pull numbers out of a hat. If you didn't get to play that night, if they didn't pull your number, so you had to sit through like 2 hours of just awful, awful stuff.
Right.
Like some decent stuff, but like somewhere you're like, oh my God. Like, and if they didn't pull it, then they you guaranteed a spot the following week for the next open mic night. So that happened to me. So I came back the following week and I got up and played like a song, and immediately like a bunch of people came up like, hey, we're going to go jam after, come hang out. They became my friends that I hung out with for 3 straight years.
That's awesome.
The people I met at that one night, it was my core nucleus that just like kind of expanded, but I still keep up with them just because of that one open mic night. It's just the weirdest. That's
cool. Like you don't necessarily get that in LA. You can, but
you can.
To have it on your first time doing an open mic like that, that is awesome. That's what I
mean. Everybody just like kind of scratches each other's back there. Like you do a songwriter in the round, you put your friends together, they'll play lead over you, you know, like it's just everybody's there just kind of looking out for each other. That was always the vibe I got. Like it was it just felt like kind of like a college experience almost. Right.
Did you get into like the writer circles, like writing for label artists and stuff like that? Did you get into
No, I got some songs put on hold and here and there, but like nothing ever really made it. And I had this little parallel track where I was like recording demos for people, as I found that a lot of the aspiring songwriters weren't really players.
Yeah.
They had much more limited vocabulary, but they're really the ones I respected. Just great with lyrics and great with ideas, and you know, but I found that like one thing I could bring to them was you know, some more on like the musical side and the, right. the chord side. But some of that was a little not quite Nashville enough. So I got told, oh, no, that's a little too LA. Like, but, awesome. You know, but I found that, like, I found a nice little niche, like recording demos for people, especially like just acoustic rhythm tracks and like even doing some vocal demos for people. So,
that's awesome.
But yeah, it was, I just felt like it was going to be a long, long road there because there's so much talent and there's not enough work to go around.
Yes.
And it just felt overwhelming to me. Like, I'm like, everywhere I looked, there were people that were good enough to be doing whatever they wanted to do, but they right. were not doing it. They were not doing it at all.
Also, it's like they call it Music City, but there's only a certain amount of venues on the drag, and it's grown since you left, but it's still the same, like, main venues are the same yes. venues to play at. And it's like right. kind of getting in there, and it's exactly what you said. It's like you have these monster talents, and they're trying to get, like, one or two nights a week, and sometimes that's not even consistent. It's so weird.
They don't even pay, though. That's the thing. Like, the places you're probably thinking of, like, on the main strip there in Broadway, like, you're working for tips.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah, so like I would be playing, like I did a couple of gigs with like these like country artists backing them up, and I remember one night, like I think the first night I did it, I was walking my car with like $15, and like I made enough to cover parking tonight. This is not sustainable. Like,
right. Right.
So, I realized I needed to do something different out there. Like, I didn't want to just be playing country covers too, because I didn't grow up in that world, and just didn't feel natural to me. You know, so it was my friend Dave moved out from LA a year after I did, and we became roommates, and we started a couple of bands together. First we tried to start a Steely Dan tribute band.
Oh my God, that's awesome. Seriously?
It was his idea, but yeah, I was kind of reluctant. I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't, this music is a little hard. Larry Carlton solos? I don't think so. Like, I don't know if I can cover Larry Carlton. I still can't. But no, it was fun. And then that became kind of that spun off into an 80s band. He's still got it out there. It's called Bueller, like Ferris Bueller.
That's awesome.
We had a blast with Bueller because nobody was doing anything like that. So we were just all of a sudden popping up all over town playing like all our favorite 80s hits, you know. And I somehow became the majority lead singer, which I didn't intend to, but it was really fun. But I remember building my dream pedal board with like all the 80s effects on it, like analog chorus and, you know, old delay pedals and stuff like that, and just lush reverb. And dude, it was so much fun. It was so much fun.
Were you gigging a lot with Bueller, or was it just like?
Yeah, no, it took off. It totally took off. And I think I did it with them for about 2 years. I just hit this like. This wall where I'm like, listen, I can be doing exactly what Bueller's doing back in California. And I just missed my family. Like I was the one missing every family event constantly, you know? And I just felt like I didn't have anyone out there. So it was like, it wasn't like, okay, I wasn't miserable, but it was more like, do I see myself here forever? Because if I do, you know, I should probably start moving towards like that direction. Ultimately, I'm a California guy. I wanted to be back here. You know,
I actually originally wanted to go to New York. Right out of school, I was ready to move to New York. I met with a vocal teacher out there, and my dad came with me. I remember. And
after USC,
that's what my plan was, to go to New York and like, because you know, it's like, okay, that's what people do. They go to New York. They audition for musical theater. They audition for jazz. They audition with bands. They play. That's where everything is. And I had a close family friend, and she gave me the best advice. She was like, we were out to dinner, and she's like, I'm going to give you some pretty harsh advice, and I'm saying it with a lot of love. And I said, okay. And she said, don't come out to New York to make it. And I was like, what? And she said, so many people come out to the city with dreams, and they end up having to work three jobs to pay rent. They don't end up good at the thing they came out here for because they're working so hard just to make it and make rent. And she's like, start your thing in LA, come to New York when New York invites you, best advice I ever heard.
And yeah.
I went back in 2010 and played the Apollo Theater. Did some really cool things. But it was really harsh advice to hear because, you know what? I think it was the best advice that I ever got because I wanted to move to New York, but I would have been away from family. I would have been in weather that I wasn't used to. I would have been working 2 to 3 jobs just to make ends meet and not doing the thing that I wanted to do to go out there. So, but the real key part of that was being away from family. I mean, that's like not fun. It's like
no.
The little moments, the birthday parties, the barbecues, the anniversary, all that.
Exactly.
Stuff, you realize that's what makes life important. So I love that moment where you're like, this is a crossroads. I'm going to move back. As much as you probably also kind of, and you know, I say this like, you probably outgrew Nashville for what you were doing there and how much you were getting out of it, right?
Well, I don't know about that. Like, I also felt like I really set out to go there to be a songwriter.
Right.
And I didn't feel like I was making any ground on that. And I felt like I had some pretty decent songs that always seemed to get good response. But, like, I just couldn't – I had some meetings here and there with people, like, you know, publishers.
Yeah, it's so much bullshit industry.
And I just couldn't seem to, like, even get past the first level. It was just – felt like this is going to be a long road.
It's kind of astounding to me because, like, if anybody's a real music person, you walk in there with your guitar chops, your songs, and your voice, it's a no-brainer to me that you should have had a publishing deal. You should have been signed to a label. And this is what's wrong with the industry. You have people that don't really know music in very powerful positions.
Mm-hmm.
Throwing that weight around. I know you worked with labels, so you know what I'm talking about. And mm-hmm. you know, Nashville's full of that too. It's like there's so many people that they don't have an eye for talent. They just get lucky occasionally with one or two artists that anybody could have gotten lucky with. So, you know,
everybody's afraid to like get their hands dirty, you know.
Yeah.
Like the stuff you and I grew up listening to, I think about this a lot. Like the stuff that my parents played in the house when I was a kid. Like my dad was a Bob Dylan fan and James Taylor and John Denver, all those. I still have like those vinyls in my head, like the covers of them and Simon and Garfunkel, you know, like most of those artists didn't even start to really break out till their second, third, or sometimes fourth album that they put out,
right.
You know, and nobody talks about their early stuff. So they had this like buffer time to kind of find their footing and grow. And now you're just expected to come out swinging and hit a grand slam on the first attempt. And, you know, if you don't, okay, well, next. And it's just, I don't know. I just don't think there are any like real A&R people that are actually developing talent.
Well, and then like real A&R people. Like,
like what it's supposed to be.
I want to play something of yours, but before I'm going to give you a really cool suggestion that you're going to love. If you have not seen the Jeff Buckley documentary on HBO,
me too.
Music Box. I've got chills already. It is so phenomenal and has everything to do with what you just said. You need to watch the movie. It is phenomenal. It is so great. I think every artist should see it. And especially Jeff Buckley's Grace record, you know, is like one of the greatest records. And the story behind it and how he got signed and what he was doing, what he was going through is really a powerful story. I knew a lot of little parts, but I also didn't know like Radiohead saw him and went and wrote Fake Plastic Trees because of him.
Oh my gosh.
Things like that. Like, oh my God, this is amazing. So you need to watch it. That's my suggestion for you now. But let's play something. What do you want to play us first? What you sent us.
So I haven't really mentioned this, but I kind of fell into performing in like for events now. That's kind of more of what I do. I play for like, you know, everything from corporate stuff to weddings or private events. So it's mostly covers now, but I sent you some of my promo videos that I used to shop around for these events. So you can put the Fleetwood Mac cover on.
Let's do that. Which song did I saw the email, but I don't know the. Is it Dreams?
Dreams.
Okay, here's Matt Heineke cover of Fleetwood Mac Dreams.
leader. Who am I to keep you down? It's only right that you should play the way you feel. Listen carefully to the sound of the loneliness that my heartbeat drives you mad. The stillness of remembering what you have, what you lost.
Slamming, dude. I'm gonna give you a huge compliment, right?
Oh,
here's the truth. Whenever you post videos of you playing these gigs, I watch your entire performances. And like, I don't do that with a lot of people, Matt.
Oh man, thank you.
Doors every time, because I've always known that it's gonna be slamming, it's gonna be it's gonna have heart, it's gonna be real. And it's just always beautiful, man. Like, that gave me chills, man. That was so good. I hope you never stop writing songs. I hope you never stop.
I need to get back to it. I do need to get back to it. It's on my list.
Just, dude, you're good. You know what I mean? Like,
thank you.
I will tell you, like, I love that you do these covers, but you need to also be writing. It's just important. You know, it's like, this is your story and this is your life in music. And you do such a killing job on all these covers. They're all so slamming. And I've seen so many of them. And I love that you're doing this too, because for me, I'm just like happy you're back in music, grinding and doing the hustle. And I see your performance dates and it makes me happy, because it's like so easy for people just to stop. And it's like, you still are out there doing it. And I know,
dude, I don't know how to do anything else. This is what I want to do.
It's like, but it's also like, it's like you were given a gift. And so you're honoring the gift, and that is nothing but a good thing. So, like, it's easy to just go, oh my God, I don't want to do this right now. It's like going to the gym. It's what I always tell people. It's like, I don't feel like doing this. And then once you're in it, you're like, God, I love this. Why would I ever think that? This is the best thing ever. And you personify that in every performance. I hope you never stop. I hope you always write. I hope you always do covers. I hope you always do these cool interpretations. I have a couple questions. First of all, it looked like it was a 0028. Was it a 0028? What was the guitar?
Ooh, close. It's an OM.
Oh, wow. Great sound.
I had that guitar built at USC. While I was there, by the David Oakes, the guy was my private teacher. He had one made by that builder. It was from the state of Maine. Sadly, he passed away a few years after he built it. But he built one for me, David Oakes, and another guitar teacher on staff, Pat Kelly. And it's an OM. It's basically an OM 28. So it's got a German spruce top. It's been beat to hell, man. That thing's like, the finish is wearing off.
All good, though. Man, but, it sounds good.
Dude, it's my number one. I have a beautiful Collings I spent twice as much money on. I reached for this one first. There's just something special about it. It's like, you know, the Natural, where he's got the lightning bolt bat, you know, it's like, that's my number one.
I know that feeling. I love it. And I love when a guitar does that. It just like, it gives you that like, oh, this feels like an old sweater that I'm always going to love. And I'm always going to feel good in this. That's what a good guitar can do. And man, it just sounded great. It just sounded great.
Thank you.
Like, even
but the weird thing is when people play it, they don't, I've had people be like, yeah, you know, the neck's kind of weird. I'm like, just, I don't care. I don't care what you think. Just shut up. But that's
you. It's like, who cares what anybody thinks? You know what I mean? It's like, I never care if somebody's like, yeah, it's cool. It's like, oh, go fuck yourself. I know it's great. That's all about it. Yes, it's awesome. It sounds amazing.
Thank you.
I want to play something else. You want to do Time After Time, or what do you want to do?
Yeah, sure. Do the Time After Time one.
Here's Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time. Nikki performing.
Go.
Lying in my bed, I hear the clock tick and think of you. Caught up in circles, confusion is nothing new. Flashback, one night almost left me a suitcase of memories. Time after, sometimes you picture me. I'm walking too far ahead. You're calling to me. I care. Go slow and fall behind. The second hand unwinds. You're lost, you can look, you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, I will catch you. I'll be waiting. Time after time, if you're lost, you can look, and you. Time after time. my picture fades and darkness has turned to gray. Watching through windows, you're wondering if I'm okay. Secrets stolen from deep inside. The drum beats out of time. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, I'll catch you. I'll be waiting. Time after time, if you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, time after time. Listen, go slow and fall behind. The second hand unwinds. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, I will catch you. I'll be waiting. Time after time, if you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time, if you fall, I will catch you. I'll be waiting. Time after time. Time after time. Time after time. Oh, oh. Time after time. Time after time.
So good, Matt. Giving me chills all over the place, man. This is so good. Dude, I have to ask, do you know Ryan Hiller by chance?
Yeah, wait. I know that name from somewhere.
He's also a songwriter, also a Killing Guitarist in San Diego.
Yeah. No, I know his name for sure. I don't know if I've met him personally.
I'm gonna link you two together. You guys should be playing shows together. You should be just jamming together. He's just a fantastic musical presence like yourself. And I was just thinking, I'm like, man, I got to connect these two guys because it's awesome. You're both awesome. So you'll love each other because you both have vocabulary. You both can sing. You can play your asses off. Just great musical energies. And you guys just need to be playing shows together. You're playing all over the place all the time. Do you have favorite spots or you just kind of like love every one of them in different ways?
Everyone in different ways. But I don't know if you know my hometown, Coronado, California. Big famous hotel here, Hotel Del Coronado.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's probably my favorite place.
Beautiful.
It's just got this magical, just like this aura about it. You just, I don't know. I grew up sneaking into that hotel as a kid. That's where my friends and I would hang out on weekends. And we go, they have the old school Victorian elevator where it was manually operated by a guy. We would like call it and ditch him, you know. I just, anytime I get to play there, I just feel like I'm in like, oh my gosh, this place is incredible. So that's definitely my favorite for sure. So it's also down the street from where I live. But
well, I want to play it. You got one more song. I want to play it.
Oh, man.
Head Over Heels. Yeah. Is that right? Who is this song? I don't know if I know this song.
Oh, it's Tears for Fears.
Oh, my God. Of course. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I love the covers that you're picking, by the way. They're like songwriter's songs. You know what I mean? They're like a songwriter's choice for songs. So I love this. Here's Tears for Fears, Head Over Heels with Matt Heineke performing.
Thanks, buddy.
Wanting to be with you,
Good, Matt. So good. My goodness. Where can people find you if they want to find you online? And
Instagram. My company name is Crowntown Music, like Coronado, Crowntown, Crown City. So Crowntown Music or crowntownmusic.com. That's where I have all the content and dates posted. But if you're down in San Diego, come see me.
And you know what? When we come down to San Diego, you need to sit in with us. That's an open invitation forever.
Oh, dude, I'm there.
You always have a seat at the table whenever I'm at the table. So
when are you down here? Do you have anything booked?
Play the Belly Up soon. We're trying to.
Oh, cool. I love Belly Up.
So we'll have to have you sit in with us. That would be so awesome.
I would love that. No, you just tell me when. I'll be there.
Matt, you're always such an amazing musical presence. I wanted to know, what was the luthier that you said, that the guitar maker? Who was it?
Tom Williamson. Unfortunately, passed away, I think, like 2006. But I don't think there are many of his guitars around. I'm very lucky to have one. I'll never, ever part ways with it.
Beautiful guitar, beautiful playing.
Thank you.
Beautiful musicianship. Matt, I'm going to have you back on our show in about 9 or 10 months, because that's what we do. That's the whole point of this. And and I just hope you keep playing music, keep writing music.
Thank you.
Keep doing your thing, man, because it's
really Thanks for cool. having me.
Of course.
Appreciate you having me.
I was so looking forward to interviewing you, because we go way back, and I had so many questions about your story. So, man, I'm going to have you back. It was such a pleasure to reconnect. And also online, just like sending each other YouTube videos.
It's
all about, man.
There's more of that to come. Yeah, I've got some stuff I want to send you. So maybe we'll run into you at NAMM this week.
Yes, I'll see you at NAMM this week. On behalf of Matt, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Peace, love.
Thanks,
take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And check out Matt's music one more time. What's your website?
CrowntownMusic.com.
CrowntownMusic.com. Check it out, people. All right, we out. Peace, love, and
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.